Fletcher's Moxie by Gregory MacDonald. Copyright 1982 by Gregory MacDonald. This recording of the reading of Fletcher's Moxie was published by arrangement with Gregory MacDonald and was produced in 1988 by Books on Tape Incorporated, which holds the copyright there too. Neither this recording nor any part thereof may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authority from Books on Tape Incorporated. Please observe the following procedures as you listen to these tapes. If you have borrowed this book from your local library, please return it to them at the end of the agreed period. If you are one of our regular rental customers, you may keep your book for 30 days from date of receipt by you, but after that time we charge additional rental of 25 cents per day. Dates are checked by postmark. Please return this book at the earliest possible time so another subscriber can have the use of this recording. To return cassettes to us, simply make sure they are all packaged in their plastic cassette cases and in proper order in the mailing container. Kindly seal the mailing container for return. Postage is already paid. Drop in any mailbox for return to Books on Tape. Unless you are at home during the day, you will probably find it more convenient to have tapes mailed to you at your business address rather than your home. Reason is that postmen cannot leave packages if no one is there to receive them. Should a cassette fail to play properly, hold it flat in the palm of your hand and slap it smartly against a hard, flat surface. If this does not work, or if you cannot otherwise free the reels, and if you are a library customer, please ask your local library to contact Books on Tape for a replacement cassette. If you are one of our rental customers, please call us at our regular customer service number. Give us the name of the book and number of the cassette. We will immediately send you a replacement at no charge. Discard the broken cassette. Fletcher's Moxie by Gregory MacDonald. This book consists of 40 chapters and is 283 pages long. The following material appears on the dust jacket of the book. Fletcher's got plenty of moxie, and she's just beautiful. Moxie's a hot movie star. She's got a dad who's one of the roaring legends of Hollywood. She's dead center in a case that begins with a sensational on-camera murder and explodes in race riots and police raids. Most of all, she's got problems, because she's the number one suspect. Fletch, the super sleuth with microphone and pen, unlocks a sizzling mystery in Key West. Chapter 1. What happened to Steve? The woman in the canvas chair leaned forward. She had not looked around from the television screen since Fletch entered the pavilion. No one else was there. She was speaking to herself or to the air. "For God's sake, what's wrong?" she said in a tight, low voice. Even under the canopy on a sunless day, the screen of the television monitor was blanched by daylight from the beach. From where Fletch was standing, he could see the pale images flickering on the screen. Across a few meters of beach, between the cameras, standing lights, reflectors, and sound booms, he could see the reality of what was on the screen, the set of the Dan Buckley Show, host and guests. In the middle chair sat Dan Buckley, wearing white trousers, loafers, and a light blue Palm Beach shirt. Even at a distance, amiability seemed stuck on his face like a decal. To his left, in a long, white, bulky dressing gown, sat Moxie Mooney, the gorgeous, perky, healthy, fresh-faced young film star called away from her makeup table to oblige an on-location talk show. To Buckley's right sat Moxie's agent, manager, and executive producer, Steve Peterman, in three-piece pearl gray suit, black shoes, and cravat. Only Steve Peterman wasn't sitting properly in his chair. He was slumped sideways. His head was on his right shoulder. Fletch looked at his watch. At the back of the talk show set, a heavy, brightly colored split curtain moved slightly in the breeze. Behind the set, down the beach, the Gulf of Mexico was gray-blue in that light. On all sides of the set was the paraphernalia of a much bigger set, the location of the film in progress, Midsummer Night's Madness, starring Moxie Mooney and Jerry Littleford. Odd-shaped trailers were parked on the beach, each facing a different direction, as if dropped there. False palm-thatched huts were here and there. Thick black cables ran every which way over the sand. Low wooden platforms, like portable dance floors, were tilted on the beach. Strewn everywhere were the odd-shaped light rigs, reflectors, cameras, and sound cranes. The whole beach looked like a sandbox of toys abandoned by a giant rich child. Among all these trappings moved the film crew of Midsummer Night's Madness, working, apparently oblivious of the taping going on in their midst. "What happened?" the woman repeated in a hoarse whisper. Fletch put his glass of orange juice back on the bar table. He stood quietly behind the woman in her canvas chair. She still hadn't looked around at him. Closer, he could see the monitor more clearly. In a loose headshot, Moxie was alone on screen, laughing. Then she looked to her right, as if seeking confirmation from Steve Peterman, as if turning the conversation over to him. Moxie stopped talking with a short, sharp inhale. Laughter left her face. One eyebrow rose. The camera pulled back to include Buckley. He looked to his right to see what had surprised Moxie. His eyes widened. His lips did not move. The camera pulled back farther. Steve Peterman's eyes stared blankly into the camera. His head was at such an odd angle, resting on his shoulder, his neck seemed broken. Blood oozed from the lower right corner of his mouth. It dribbled down his cheek, past his ear, and onto his cravat. In the pavilion, the woman in the canvas chair screamed. She stood up. She screamed again. People everywhere on the beach, even on the talk show set, were looking at her. She clasped her hands over her mouth. Fletch took her arm. Gently, firmly, he turned her body toward him. Her eyes were affixed to the monitor. "Come on," he said. "Time for a break."
"What's happening? What happened to Steve?"
"Coffee," he said. "They'll be right back." He turned her away from the reality of what was happening on the set and away from the unreality of what was happening focused on the television screen.
"Steve,"
she called. He made her walk. She stumbled against the canvas chair. He pushed it out of her way with his bare foot. "Come on," he said. "Let's see what the canteen has to offer."
"But Steve,"
she said. She put her hands over her face. He put his arm around her shoulder and guided her along. He walked with her off the pavilion and up the beach to the flat, hard-packed parking lot. There were many trailers parked there. In a reasonable tone of voice, Fletch said, "I don't think there's anything you can do just now." Chapter 2. "Is Steve Peterman your husband?" Fletch asked. He was careful to use the word "is" rather than "was," although he was sure the latter was appropriate. In the metal folding chair, her drawn face nodded in the affirmative.
"I'm Marge Peterman."
Fletch had found two metal chairs and placed them behind a trailer in the parking lot, out of the way of the traffic he knew would be passing to and from the beach. He sat Marge Peterman in one and went to the canteen. He brought back two cups of coffee, one black, the other with cream and sugar. He offered her both. She chose the black. He put the other coffee on the sand near her feet and sat quietly in the other chair. Fletch had arrived at the location of Midsummer Night's Madness on Bonita Beach only a half hour before. His credentials from Global Cable News had gained him entry onto location. The security guard told him Moxie was taping the Dan Buckley show and enjoined Fletch to silence. He directed Fletch to the hospitality pavilion, where a courtesy bar had been set up to host the television crew and other press after the taping. There he had found a woman sitting alone on a canvas chair watching her husband on a television monitor. Now they were sitting together behind a trailer at the edge of a parking lot. She had sipped her coffee cup dry and then picked the styrofoam cup to little pieces. Bits of styrofoam were in her lap and on the sand around her feet like crumbs.
"When are they going to tell me what happened?"
she asked. She could have rebelled from Fletch's ministrations and found out for herself. She didn't. She had understood enough of what she had seen to prefer acute anxiety to dead certainty. "Breathe deeply," Fletch said. She took a deep breath and choked off a sob. The rescue squad ambulance was the first to arrive. Blue lights flashing on the gray day, it threaded its way slowly and carefully down onto the beach. A police car arrived next, its siren and lights on, but seemingly in no great hurry. Some local police had already been assigned to the film location. Then two more police cars came screaming, skidding in, as if their drivers hoped the cameras were on. Out of the passenger seat of one emerged a middle-aged woman in uniform. Marge Peterman said, "If they take Steve to the hospital, I want to go with him." Fletch nodded. The ambulance had not returned from the beach, as it would have if there were any necessity to go to the hospital. "I mean, I want to go with him in the ambulance." Fletch nodded again. Most of the people, the film crew, the television crew, the press, had gone down to the beach like pieces of metal being drawn by a magnet. Now a few were returning. As they returned, they walked with their chins down. Their shoulders seemed higher than normal, and the skin beneath their tans seemed touched by bleach. None was talking. Fletch could not hear the murmur of the gulf or even the chatter of the birds among the palm trees. An airplane taking off from Fort Myers passed overhead. A young woman in shorts, a halter, and sandals appeared around the corner of the trailer and stopped. She looked back toward the beach, wondering what to do, looking for support. A man with a large stomach extending a dark blue T-shirt with dark curly hair, a light meter dangling from a string around his neck, arrived and stood next to the young woman. He kept looking at Marge Peterman's back. A young policeman joined them. He shoved his hat back off his sweaty forehead and looked toward the road, probably wishing there were traffic to direct. One or two other people came to stand with them. Dan Buckley came around the corner of the trailer and looked at each of the people standing there. He, too, hesitated. Then he slowly came forward and put his hand on Marge Peterman's shoulder. She looked up at him. "Dan." Fletch gave Buckley his chair and stood aside. "Mrs. Peterman," Dan Buckley said. "Marge, is it?"
"Yes."
"Marge." He leaned forward in the chair, forearms on his thighs. "It seems your husband... It seems Steve is dead. I'm sorry, but..." Buckley's face lost none of its confident amiability in its seriousness, its sadness. Watching him, Fletch wished that if he ever had to take such bad news, it'd be broken to him by such a professional face as Dan Buckley's. In Buckley's face, there was the built-in assurance that no matter how bad the present facts, there would be a world tomorrow, a show tomorrow, a laugh tomorrow. Marge Peterman stared at Buckley. "What do you mean, seems to be?" Her chin quivered. "Seems to be dead?" Buckley's hands cupped hers. "Is dead. Steve is dead, Marge." Her face rejected the news, then crumpled in tears. She took her hands from him and put them to her face.
"What happened?" she choked. "What happened to Steve?"
Buckley looked up at Fletch. Then he sat back in the chair. His eyes ran along a heavy-duty cable strung over the parking lot. He said nothing. The young woman in the halter came forward and put both her hands on Marge Peterman's shoulders. "Come on," she said. Marge stood up and staggered on the flat ground. The man in the blue T-shirt took her arm. Together, the man and the young woman walked Marge Peterman through the trailers to the front of the parking lot. "What did happen?" Fletch asked Buckley. Buckley focused on Fletch. "Who are you?" he asked. Fletch was wearing sailcloth shorts, a tennis shirt, and no shoes. "The ambassador from Bermuda?" "Sometimes I get coffee for people," Fletch said. Buckley looked over the bits of styrofoam on the sand. "He got stabbed." He shook his head. "He got a knife stuck in his back, right on the set, right on camera." "He was quiet about it," Fletch commented. Buckley was looking at his fingers in his lap as if he had never seen them before. "It could not have happened. It absolutely could not have happened." "But it did, though, huh?" Buckley looked up. "Get me a cup of coffee, will you, kid? Black, no sugar." "Black, no sugar," Fletch repeated. Fletch walked toward the canteen, passed it, through the security gate, got into his rented car, and drove off. Chapter 3. The first phone call Fletch made was to Global Cable News in Washington, D.C. His call got through to that hour's producer quickly. It was, "Yes, sir, Mr. Fletcher. Yes, sir, Mr. Fletcher," all the way through the switchboard and production staff. Recently, Fletch had bought a block of stock in Global Cable News, just 10 days before he had toured their offices and studios in Washington. He had allowed everyone to know he was a journalist and they might be hearing from him from time to time. "Yes, sir, Mr. Fletcher," said that hour's producer. Fletch looked down at his bare feet on the rotten, sand-studded floorboards of the porch outside the mini-mart. When he was working full-time as a journalist, no one in power had ever called him sir. They had called him many other things. He had always known, of course, that behind the power of the free press was the power of the buck. He had never felt the sensation of the power of the buck before. He decided he liked the sensation, and that he must work to deprive himself and others of any such sensation. A barefoot boy with cheek should be listened to because he's got a story, not because he was able to buy a few shares in the company. "Sir," Fletch said. "To whom am I speaking, please?"
"Jim Finelli, Mr. Fletcher. We met last week when you were here. I'm the bald guy with the big side whiskers."
"Oh, yeah," Fletch said. Jim Finelli looked like a stepped-on cotton pod. "The gumdrop fetishist." "That's me," Finelli chuckled. "A box a day keeps the dentist healthy, wealthy, and sadistic." "You know the Dan Buckley show?"
"Sure. My mother-in-law fantasizes she's married to the creep."
"They were taping down here on Bonita Beach this afternoon, on location for a movie called Midsummer Night's Madness."
"Cute. Prospero's Island in Florida."
Fletch said nothing. No matter how long he lived, he would be amazed at the great mishmash of information and misinformation all journalists carry around in their heads.
"Have I got it right?" Finelli asked.
"Sure, sure. On the set of the television show were Buckley, Moxie Mooney, and her manager, Steve Peterman."
"So? Mr. Fletcher, are you trying to get a publicity shot for somebody? I mean, are you invested in the film or something? I mean, anything regarding Moxie Mooney will fly. She's gorgeous, but where's Bonita Beach anyway, north of Naples?"
"Yeah, more south of Fort Myers. Call me Fletch, makes me feel more like me."
"Well, that's a hike. We'd have to send people over from Miami. You stockholders, you know, like us to keep our expenses down."
"Send people over from Miami. Steve Peterman was murdered."
"Who?"
"Peterman. Stephen Peterman. Not sure if Stephen is spelled with a V or a PH. On television, it doesn't matter how his name is spelled anyway, right?"
"Who is he again?"
"Some sort of a manager, a friend of Moxie Mooney. Some kind of a producer of Midsummer Night's Madness."
"Yeah, but so what? Nobody knows who he is."
"You haven't got the point yet."
"My father lives in Naples. It's nice down there."
"He was stabbed to death on the set of the Dan Buckley show while they were taping, while the cameras were running." There was a pause on the other end of the line.
"Yeah, that's good," Finelli said.
"You mean they don't know who did it yet? They will as soon as they look at the tapes. Fast story, a 6-hour wonder. I'm not saying it's a bad story."
"Someone was murdered on camera."
"Yeah, but it wasn't a live show. It should be reported, of course." "Obviously, both Moxie Mooney and Dan Buckley are suspects. They were the only ones within reach." There was another pause while Finelli marshaled in his mind his own camera sound crew, on-camera reporter, his visuals, his story approach, his electronic pickup. The mini-mart was off the only road leading into Fort Myers Beach. Several of the cars and vans Fletch had seen in the parking lot of the Midsummer Night's Madness location had gone by on the road while he was on the telephone. As he was leaving the beach, police loudspeakers had been ordering everyone present to report to the local police station. Because of security on location, police would have the identities of everyone who had been there, of every potential witness. Among these names, they would have to have the identity of the murderer.
"When did this incident occur?" Finelli asked.
3:23 p.m.
"Can we go on the air with this right away?"
"I'm sure AP Radio News has already run it."
"What do we have they don't have?"
"Beg pardon?"
"You got a new angle to the story? Like, I mean, new news?" On the road, a white Lincoln Continental went by. Moxie was in the front passenger seat. Fletch couldn't see who was in the back seat.
"Yeah," Fletch said. "One of the prime suspects is about to disappear."
"Yeah, which one?"
"Moxie Mooney."
The second phone call was to the Five Aces Horse Farm near Ocala, Florida.
"Ted Sills," Fletch said to whoever answered the phone. "This is Fletcher."
Fletch waited a long time. He ran his mind over the rambling ranch house, the swimming pool area, the two guest cottages, the stables, the paddocks, the tack room, all the handsome aspects of Five Aces Farm. At that hour of the day, Ted Sills would be in the tack room talking veterinary medicine and racing strategy over Thai beer with his trainer, whose name really was Frizzlewit. There was no breeze on the porch of the mini-mart. It was a gray, sultry day.
"Yes, sir, Fletch," Ted's voice finally boomed into the phone. "You coming by?"
"Just wanted to see if you're using your house in Key West."
"For what?" Ted Sills said. "I'm here at the farm."
"Then may I use your house in Key West?"
"No."
"Oh, thanks.
What are you talking about?"
"Want to get away for a few days."
"From what? You're always away. Where are you now?"
"Southwest Florida."
"You want to go to Key West?"
"Yeah."
"There's some nice hotels there."
"Don't want a hotel. Hate to be awakened in the morning by work-eager maids."
"So you don't have to make the bed. Hotels make your breakfast for you, too."
"Need a little P&Q.
"That mean peace and quiet?"
"It do."
"I need the $9,000 you owe me in feed bills."
"That much?"
"The horses you have training here at Five Aces do eat, you know. A racehorse cannot train on an empty stomach, you know. A racehorse, like the rest of us, is encouraged by getting its victuals regular, you know."
"You'll have it in the morning. Now, may I borrow your house?"
"The house rents for $12,000 a month."
"$12,000 what?"
$12,000.
12 is in after 11 followed by 13?
"The very same 12. You're very good at figures, Fletch, except when it comes to writing them on checks for feed bills."
"You let me stay in the blue house for free when you were trying to sell me some slow racehorses."
"What do you mean, slow racehorses? You had a winner last week."
"Really?"
"Speedo Demon won the fourth at Hialeah. You should have been there."
"How much was the purse?"
"Let me see. Your share was $270.
"Some race."
"Well, it was a plug race, and the favorite was scratched."
"Good old Speedo."
"She was faster than five other horses."
"Did the fans stay for the whole race?"
"Fletch, someone's got to own the losers."
"Why me?"
"I expect they sense that you resent their feed bills. Horses aren't dumb that way. Racehorses are like a certain kind of woman, you know. You gotta spoil them with a smile on your face."
"Okay, feed the horses, but damn it, Ted, make sure their overshoes are buckled before you put them in a race, will you?"
"We always buckle their overshoes."
"Now, about the blue house."
"No."
"I only want it for a few days."
$12,000. I wouldn't rent it for just a few days. Wouldn't be worth changing the bed sheets."
"You rent it very often at that price?"
"Nope, never before."
Ted,
I've never rented it before. I don't want to rent it. I put a price on it just because you asked, as a friend."
"Okay, as a friend, I'll take it."
"You will?"
"I will."
"Boy, no other sucker was born the minute you were."
"Make sure the bed sheets are changed."
"That's $21,000 you owe me."
"So some weeks are more expensive than others."
"Will I get the money?"
"In the morning, in nickels and dimes."
"You don't really care about money, do you? I mean, you have no sense of money, Fletch. I've noticed that about you."
"Money's useful when you have to blow your nose."
"Maybe I'll drop by while you're there. There are a couple of other racehorses I'd like to talk to you about."
"Don't expect to stay in your own house, Ted. You'll find the room rent very expensive."
No, I'd stay at a hotel. I'll phone down to the Lopez's. They'll open the house for you. You going down tonight?
Yep.
I'll tell the Lopez's you tip well.
Do. And tell good old Speedo Demon a happy munchin' for me.
Fletch didn't need his credit card for the third phone call he made. It was to the airport in Fort Myers. The man Fletch spoke to there repeated three times that Fletch was chartering a one-way flight from Fort Myers to Key West with no stops, which made it four times he said it altogether. There was something hard, almost threatening, in the man's voice when he said, "with no stops." "There will be no dope aboard the plane," Fletch finally assured him, "except me." Fletch pushed open the door to the mini-mart. The woman behind the counter was Cuban. She looked at his smile and said with an impeccable accent, "How do you do? You need shoes to come in the store." "Can you direct me to the police station?" Fletch asked. Immediately, her face expressed genuine concern. "Is there some problem?" She glanced through the window. "Trouble?" Fletch grinned more broadly. "Of course." Chapter 4. The lobby of the police station looked like the departure point for a summer camp. The film and television crews sat around in various combinations of shorts, jeans, t-shirts, halters, sandals, boots, sneakers, sunglasses, western hats, warm-up jackets. Plastic and leather sacks bulging with their equipment hung from their shoulders and lay at their feet. Fletch had put moccasins on before entering the station. The local press, two wearing neckties, stood in a clump in the middle of the lobby. There were lightweight sound cameras among them. Fletch leaned against the frame of the front door. All these various people engaged in getting various kinds of reality onto various kinds of film eyed each other with friendly distance, like members of different denominations at a religious convention. They were all brothers in the faith, but they worshipped at different altars. A few looked at Fletch curiously, but no group claimed him. He was not proselytizing. Around the room were a few familiar faces he had never seen before in person. Edith Howell, who played older women, mothers, these days. John Hoyt, who played fathers, businessmen, lawyers, sheriffs. John Mead, who played the local yokel in any locale. The young male lead, Jerry Littleford, sat on a bench along the wall in white duck trousers and a skin-tight black t-shirt. Like a well-designed sports car, even at rest, he looked like he was going 300 kilometers an hour. His lean body seemed molded by the wind. His black skin shone with energy. His dark eyes reflected light as they flashed around the room, seeing everything, watching everybody at once, missing nothing. The girl in the halter, who had been kind to Marge Peterman, was next to him, leaning against a wall, chewing a thumbnail. Marge Peterman was not there. There was a short, thin, weather-beaten man Fletch had not seen before, even on film, wearing some sort of a campaign hat and longer shorts than others wore. Fletch noticed him now because he was the only other person in the room who did not seem a part of any group. The booking desk was to the left. Across the lobby from it, between two brown doors, was a secretary's desk. One door was labeled Chief of Police, the other Investigations. The instant the door marked Investigations opened, the two mini-cameras were hefted onto shoulders, unnaturally white lights went on, and the two men in neckties, holding up pen-sized microphones like priests about to give blessings, stepped forward. The other reporters followed them. Her head neither particularly up nor down, her eyes looking directly at no one, Moxie Mooney came through the door and started slowly across the lobby. She was a saddened, concerned person, momentarily oblivious to others, despite the light, despite the noise. Using a Brazilian dance step which hadn't been invented yet and elbows which had had much practice, Fletch shoved forward with the rest of the press. The reporters were murmuring polite questions. "How do you feel? Will shooting continue on Midsummer Night's Madness?" Fletch's voice was the loudest and sharpest of all. "Ms. Mooney, did you kill Steve Peterman?" All the reporters jerked their heads to look at him, and some of them even gasped. Moxie Mooney's deep brown eyes settled on him and narrowed. Fletch repeated, "Did you kill Steve Peterman?"